You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Welcome to Radical Australian Community Radio 3CR, streaming live on 3cr.org.au. This week we conclude the two-part series with Mr. Drew Hutton, a foundation member of the Australian Greens, 50 years of activism, mainly in Queensland. How are you, Daryl?
Yes, good, thanks, Joe.
Okay, have you lined up young Drew?
I have. I got him sitting right there. Would you like to speak to him now?
Oh, I think so, yeah, why not?
Oh, well,
yeah.
Let's bring him in then.
Right. Drew, can you hear us?
Hi, Joe, how are you?
Good, all the way from Brisbane, Queensland, the land of the whatever. Perpetual sunshine. Now, we got to you standing with this motley crew of early Greens as Lord Mayor of Brisbane, and you got the wonderful vote, I think it was 1.4% or something, is that correct?
4%, Joe.
4%, my apologies. That was my vote, 1.4, not yours. So, you've got this motley crew of Greens, you've got Greens, you know, kind of not organised around the country. So how did you, what happened next in terms of forming the actual, the Australian Greens?
Oh, well, there were a few, half successful goes at getting a Green Party up. There was a big conference in Sydney in 1986.
Right.
Called the Getting Together Conference, which at which I tried to get an Australian Green Party going, but there were all sorts of different views about it. Some people thought the Democrats were a Green Party and we should go with that.
Mm-hmm.
Others thought the Labor Party was doing well. Others didn't want a Green Party at all. Some people wanted a Green Party in every shared household in the country.
And, right.
nothing really came out of that.
Were there people from across the country?
Oh yeah, about 600 people came.
600 people. So how did that meeting function? You got 600 disparate people with, looks like 600 disparate ideas.
Oh well, we organised a whole lot of different workshops and speakers.
Right.
And into a conference. It was a good conference actually.
Right.
And a number of quite good initiatives came out of it.
So right.
One of them was actually for a Green Party. So, I just went back to doing environmental work and environmental advocacy.
Right.
And I joined a national organisation called the Rainbow Alliance, which wasn't a political party, wasn't a Green Party, but it was a political movement, and it was green in its orientation.
Right.
That was the case until about 1990.
So what happened in 1990?
Well, I went down to Tasmania and met up with Bob Brown.
Right.
I'd known Bob for a few years, and we had lunch in Parliament House. He was a member of Parliament at that time.
Right.
And one of us said, and we can't remember which one of us it was, said, do you think it might be time for an Australian Green? And so we got together with a number of other key activists around the country and started talking it around. And
right.
We had a number of meetings like that. And finally, we decided we would bring everyone together and see what we could do. And we did that in 1991. There was one conference. It exploded into all sorts of...
So where was that held?
I think that was held in Sydney.
Right, you're right.
And there were people from different Trotskyist organisations who wanted to stay in those organisations but join the Greens as well.
Right.
There were others who wanted a very decentralised and almost non-organised organisation.
Right.
And Bob and I were wanting a national Green, and we actually won out with that argument, although it wasn't quite the sort of organisation we wanted. It was more focused on the state than we wanted. But anyway, we got an Australian Green up and running after a conference in Sydney in 1992.
So that's when you registered it, when it was registered as a political party?
Well, yes. Well, there was that was also a big big controversy too, because different groups actually owned the registration with the Electoral Commission.
What, the Australian Greens?
Well, yes, the ownership of the Green Party, yes.
Right.
Was actually in the hands of a number of different people, including me, I might add. I was one of them.
Right.
But there were various others, including socialist parties and you know, groups like that. So finally, we were able to get that ownership vested in the Australian Greens, and we went on from there to start contesting elections.
Right. So what year did you start contesting election as the Australian Greens?
1993, actually.
1993. And what, at the local level, state level, federal level, all levels?
Well, actually, in Queensland, we started in 1992, state election.
Right. How did you fare?
We had... we didn't do too badly, you know. I tell people this, and they sort of look at me as though I'm a bit crazy, but... We actually had a state election here in Queensland,
right?
Where we contested 27 seats, and sorry, it wasn't that many. It was, but it was over 20 seats, and we had a fund of $27,000,
right,
for the whole election.
Yep,
and we had we got people with. Yeah, over 10. We had quite a few with over 10% of the vote. I think we had about five electorates where we got more than 10% of the vote. I think over those 20 odd seats, we got something. We averaged something like about 6 or 7%.
Right. So, now, a lot of people think of Queensland as some type of radical backwater. I don't think they understand their history.
Yeah,
I mean, it's got a long, long radical past. Including the election of the only member of the Communist Party into a government position in the state government.
Anarchists in outback Queensland.
That's right, during the Shearer strike.
So we, and of course, in more recent times, there have been big campaigns for free speech against the Bjelke-Petersen government here in Queensland. So, and, you know, there was a big peace movement, conservation battles. People forget that somebody like Judith Wright, the great poet, led the battle here in Queensland to protect the Great Barrier Reef.
Right.
So the very honourable and worthwhile and productive campaign.
And then obviously there was I can't remember her Aboriginal name, the Caff Walker, from Stradbroke Island, that great poet also.
Yes.
Sometimes when you find yourself at the battering end of oppression, you kind of tend to, you know, be able to, you know, you fight back. And that's what I think people forget, that a lot of radicals from Queensland left the state and went interstate and have made a significant contribution to radical politics in various ways across the country.
Including yourself, Joe.
Well, maybe it was a mistake leaving the home country, but I don't think so. Look, I don't regret at all leaving Queensland at the end of 1976, because I was banned from every public hospital job at the end of my internship. So, you know, if I wanted a medical career, I had to leave. It was that simple. That's what they used to do, They used to just ban people. You just couldn't work.
Well, I was lucky to keep my teaching job, actually.
Yeah, I remember you were telling us last year, you know, they check in on you. And that was the problem, because if there was any sniff of any type of opposition, they'd do anything they could to actually, you know, shut you down. So how did did you have any much opposition from other groups in Queensland?
The Labor Party, of course. And,
people more on the extreme right, or...
Oh, right, yeah. Oh, well, yeah, but I've actually never been bashed, which is...
that's something to be proud of in Queensland.
I'm grateful for. Come close a few times.
But, yeah.
Look, I think people have a slightly wrong idea about Queensland. It's not a different part of the world to the rest of Australia.
Right.
We've had some rough times, but they probably shouldn't make too big a deal about it.
People should understand the police were totally corrupt and they were totally in the pocket of the Bjelke-Petersen regime. Remember the late Senator George Georges, the left-wing ALP senator in Queensland? Every time he'd turn up to a free speech protest, or because you couldn't even protest, you couldn't even get three people together without being bashed, he'd be bashed. He was a senator and chucked in the back of a paddy wagon. I remember quite clearly seeing those things happen.
The police, I'd go into the city to do some shopping
and
I'd get followed by the police.
Yeah.
I can remember one time I had three of them walking behind me and I stopped at a don't walk sign and one of them said to me, "Now, don't you walk against the don't walk sign, Mr. Hutton."
Jaywalking, very serious political crime.
Very serious, very serious.
So when did you branch into federal politics in Queensland, the Queensland Greens?
Oh, well, I stood as the Senate candidate in 1993, actually.
Right. And what was the program at that stage?
The traditional Green program, the four pillars of Green politics, ecological sustainability, democracy, social justice and non-violence.
Right.
We grouped policies around those four pillars, and they weren't bad policies either for the day, and for the fact that we're still just a small party and really having to work off no resources and a fairly small membership.
Yeah. How did the rest of the extra-parliamentary activists view the Greens? Were you viewed as traitors, or the fact that you'd taken up electoral politics, or...?
Not as traitors, no.
Right,
but,
no.
But
Misguided?
Some of them.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of them were just wedded to the Labor Party. They were so used to, coming in behind the Labor Party at election time. And,
right.
And then lobbying the Labor Party to get anything that the Labor Party was prepared to give.
Right.
And my argument always was, you can put even more pressure on a Labor government by supporting the Greens. And seeing Greens getting elected to various parliaments.
Right.
Because they can get in there, they can advocate the sorts of policies that you really want, not the crumbs that fall from the Labor table.
Right. So did the party in its early days have national congresses, this before the year 2000, or national meetings?
We did, we had a national conference every year.
Right.
And always have had. It was, once again, they were always difficult. Sometimes they were held in, pretty out-of-the-way places, some pretty dark, cold halls.
Right,
yeah. Because, once again, we had no resources, had to build that up, because business wasn't going to support it. The union weren't supporting it. I paid out of my own pocket for much of what I was doing. I was travelling all around the state, trying to set up branches. I'd sleep in people's homes on the floor or in my car.
Right.
Even a couple of times I remember standing up in the middle of the mall in the centre of town, brooking away, trying to encourage people to join this new party.
Right. And was there much interest?
We started establishing branches all around the state, everywhere from Cairns through the Gold Coast. We got branches going by about 1998, 2000. We had a viable statewide organisation, and other states were doing the same. There was always a good organisation in Tasmania, of course, but then New South Wales started building up. Western Australia finally decided they were part of Australia.
Right.
Victoria, after a while, came, and the ACT.
Right. So, West Australia's always been a little bit lagged behind.
Oh, well,
it wasn't until 1901 they had a referendum, which they joined the Federation. So,
well, I think a lot of them are still, you know, not sure that they did join.
You want to hear a funny story? You want to hear a funny story?
Yes.
Well, it's true. The 1936, I think it was, the West Australian government wanted to secede from Australia. So they went to the Privy Council in England, and the Privy Council decided in its wisdom that 2 years previously they had passed in the English Parliament passed legislation that they wouldn't interfere in the politics of former colonies. So they were denied by the Privy Council the right to secede from Australia. That's how serious it was, yeah.
Well, they must have forgotten about that non-interference policy in 1975, eh?
Yeah, they must have, yeah. Well, they didn't do it kind of... Well, it is 50 years this year for the dismissal of the Whitlam Labor government. I think a lot of people have forgotten. It's 50 years. So what was your relationship like with the... in these early stages with the ALP in Queensland? Did you exchange preferences, or were you just seen as the enemy, you know, the new kids on the block to be, you know, pushed aside?
The first thing is they were pretty outraged that we'd set up, because, you know, as far as they were concerned, this was their territory and how dare we enter into it.
Mm.
And then they said, well, we're here, but you're part of the ALP, really. You know, so just, you know, accept that, you know, you're here at our with our tolerance.
Mm.
And basically trying to tell us what we can do and what our policies should be, and, you know, of course we should give them preferences. So I called them out, actually. Said, no, you're not going to automatically get our preferences. And, you know, we're our own party. And, it was pretty tense there for a few years.
Right.
And it finally got through to them that, you know, they had to accept that we were the new kids on the block and we were going to stay there.
Right. So the party itself in Queensland, when did it first have an electoral victory?
It took a long time, Joe.
How long did it take? This is what people don't understand. In electoral politics, things take time.
Yes, well, in Queensland especially, because there's no proportional representation in Queensland. We don't have an upper house.
That's
so,
right.
So you can't, you know, in Victoria, New South Wales, and so on, you can you've got an upper house with that proportional representation, and it's relatively easy to get somebody elected. In Queensland, no upper house. Everything else is preferential voting, except for the Senate. There was a small chance of getting somebody elected to the Senate, and I came close a couple of times. The closest I came was in 2004.
Right.
When I got, I think it was between 5% and 6% of the vote.
Right.
And actually, it was just Barnaby Joyce actually just pushed me out to get that final Senate seat.
Right.
2004. It took until 2010.
Right.
Before we actually had somebody in Queensland elected. But of course, we had people elected in other states. Bob Brown had been elected to the Australian Senate in 1996. Kerry Nettle from New South Wales got elected soon after, in 1998. She was first elected. And a fellow called Michael Organ,
right,
was elected in a by-election in southern South Coast of New South Wales. That was in the late 1990s.
Wow.
Western Australia had senators. They had a good organisation in Western Australia, and they had Joe Valentine, first of all, and then Dee Margette and Christabel Shamret both got elected to the Senate from Western Australia. So we had representation, and increasingly we got representation in state upper house and in local government. This was in by the early 2000s. We were an established party, and we had a future.
Right. So what were the main issues the Queensland Greens were promoting at that stage? You know, when they first got elected in 2010 into the Senate, what propelled them into the Senate, do you think?
Well, in Queensland, you've always got environmental issues. It's really a beautiful state, Queensland, and it's got some wonderful natural treasures that, you know, always need to be fought for, against resource industries, which are usually very irresponsible. So whether you're talking about mining or agriculture, pastoral industry, the gas industry later on, you've always got, you know, some powerful resource industries which have got the ear of government, and you have to fight really hard to get any sort of victories in that situation. So environmental issues were always on the agenda with us.
Right.
There were other issues. There was important to democratic issues always on the go in Queensland.
Right.
There's always a bit of a tendency towards authoritarianism. And there are policies across the board.
So what type of extra-parliamentary campaigns that you remember that the Greens were prominent in Queensland? Because obviously the Greens is not just a political party that stands in elections, it also is involved in extra-parliamentary activity constantly.
Yeah, mining was a big one.
Mining.
Yeah.
Do you remember any particular campaigns?
Oh, I just never stopped campaigning about mining. So the main one was that, and it's always been a problem, is just getting mines to rehabilitate their sites.
Right.
There's some absolute nightmares out there that will never be fixed. And, I was constantly ranging around the state trying to highlight just how bad some of these were and how they badly needed to be fixed. And, of course, trying to stop all sorts of irresponsible projects getting a green flag from the government.
Oh, could you just give some examples, you know? Any examples that come to mind?
The Century Zinc mine was a big one.
Right.
The all sorts of coal mines, expansions of existing coal mines, new coal mines.
Right.
There's a big coal mine on the Darling Downs, I remember. We had this, and that's still going, that particular site. That's been going for years now. That was pretty huge. Pollution generally, that's the area in environmental work that I did most in. And I'm probably best known for is trying to combat, you know, the pollution outcomes from irresponsible resource industry activity.
Right. That would include, obviously, the Great Barrier Reef. And
yes, it did. Great Barrier Reef. Tourism development along the coast.
Right.
That's always a big problem in Queensland.
I remember the Gold Coast when I was a kid. You'd go down there and, you'd swim. There'd be nothing there. But now, I was there a few years ago. I couldn't believe it. It was just Las Vegas in Queensland.
Well, they keep wanting to put Las Vegas all up and down the coast.
Do they? Right. Oh, God. I can't believe it. So when did you stop standing?
Well, I missed out on the Senate in 2004.
Right.
I stood again the last time, I think, the local government in 2006.
Right.
I got 26% of the vote.
Mm-hmm.
And came pretty, reasonably close to getting elected, but didn't get elected. Bob Brown once called me the best politician Queensland never had.
Right.
I was never quite sure whether that was a compliment or not. But
well, I think he was being facetious there, you know, as well as a compliment. It's a two-edged sword there, Drew, I think. Well, the thing is, they got it easy, haven't they? They've got what? They've got to get 60,000 votes to get elected to the Senate. Give me a break, you know? That's the trouble with federation, isn't it? The little states are just as important as the big states.
That's right, yeah.
You know?
I never I never begrudge them because they produce two of the best politicians Australia's ever had. That's Bob Brown and Christine Milne.
And why do you say they're two of the best politicians Australia's ever had?
Why do I say that?
I mean, that's a big statement, you know?
Yeah, well, Bob is just unique. It's funny, he has no real political background. His background is actually in conservation.
Right.
And yet he has the ability almost to intuitively know what's the right thing to do and what's not. I mean, he's made mistakes like we all have.
Right.
But he's very good with people. He understands, you know, strategic issues really well, and he knows how to keep an organisation together and provide that sort of charismatic leadership that, you know, was required. And Christine is just one of these powerhouses who really knows, the environment and really knows how to just, you know, dig her heels in, work hard,
right,
and get a good outcome. They're two, really exceptional people, once-in-a-generation politicians, really.
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
So after you failed to be the best politician that was never elected in Queensland, did you branch out into other activities?
Well, I decided in 2009 that I'd been around the Greens long enough, and it was time for others to take over and forge new directions. And I wasn't quite sure what I was going to do with myself, but I was still reasonably young. What was I in 2009?
Oh, you would have been what, in your 60s?
Yeah, in my 60s. And 62, I think.
Yeah.
And I was just really, I did a bit of, I was teaching at the university when I retired in 2002.
So what were you teaching?
I did a bit of part-time university work. Universities would call me up and say, do you want to teach a course on this?
Or right.
Give a lecture on that. And I was doing that. And then my wife, Libby, was teaching at the university in Toowoomba, University of Southern Queensland.
Right.
And she knew some farmers out there who came to see her and told her about this new phenomenon called coal seam gas that was occurring on the Darling Downs, Queensland.
Beautiful. And people don't know Darling Downs. That's the Queensland agricultural heart, basically.
Oh, absolutely. It's just beautiful country.
Beautiful soil, beautiful country, lots of water.
So they said to her, we don't know what to do with this. And there was also coal mining was projected for the Darling Downs as well.
Right.
The whole idea of putting coal mines and coal seam gas wells all over this most beautiful, cropping country was just hideous and to this. And anyway, she called me in, and I didn't know what to do.
This reminds me of the marriage between the old BLF in Sydney and the Blue Rinse Saints. Blue Rinse, mob on the North Shore in the 70s. This reminds me of the early 70s.
Well,
you actually talking to farmers. Come on, didn't they throw rocks at you when they saw you?
well, actually, Jack Mundy was an old friend of mine. It's a good comparison. But
yeah, tell us. We'll digress, because I think a lot of people have forgotten who Jack Mundy was and how important he was. So, who was Jack Mundy, and why should we remember him?
Jack Mundy was the secretary of the Builder Savers Federation in Sydney, and he allied with a whole lot of middle class conservationists, heritage protectors around Sydney, to stop all sorts of ill advised developments in Sydney at that stage, because Sydney was basically controlled by mafia types. in those days.
Including the Premier. They made Bjelke Petersen look like an amateur.
Only was, yes, compared with...
To them, it was structural. Bribes were the order of the day. I mean, people went disappearing. What was the name of the...
Juanita Nielsen.
That's Juanita right, disappeared Nielsen, because, you know, obviously she was murdered for...
People even know what building she's buried under.
Right.
Anyway, Jack and I were friends because we, the word green actually originally came from that whole green band thing.
That's right.
So he was a good man, Jack. He was a really good man.
Right.
I loved him to death.
Right.
We got on very well together. But anyway, I think the comparison you draw is a really good one because I started... I read in the paper that there were these blockies. Blockies are poor landholders, on about 30 acres of ground, which couldn't grow anything other than goannas. And but they were having their homes invaded by these coal-seam gas companies.
Because they've got the miners' right, haven't they? They've got a right to actually go and explore your property. You can't keep them out, can you?
All they have to do is sign an access and compensation agreement with the landholder.
Right.
And that becomes important, actually, strategically. But before I get to that...
Right.
I read in the paper that these blockies had a bit of a demonstration in Dolby, in the town of Dolby on the Darling Downs. I thought, oh, that's interesting. If they're prepared to put up a bit of a fight, there might be, some hope here. So
right.
I got in touch with these people and went out there, talked to them. They gave me this video about gas fracking in the United States and the incredibly awful effects that was having on water and people's health and the land itself in various parts of the United States. And thought, okay, I think I know what I should do now. So I went back out there and I started basically just going from farmhouse to farmhouse and knocking on doors. I went to one guy's place, one of the first fellows I went to, actually, and he saw me coming up the driveway and he said, oh, you're Drew Hutton, aren't you? And I said, yeah. He said, you're the bastard who caused all my problems in the first place. he meant land clearing. They all blame me for the land clearing laws here in Queensland.
Right, to stop land clearing, Well, that's what I said. That's what I said. Well, I thought, if I'd see you coming up the driveway, mate, I'd be throwing rocks at you because of your green credentials over the years and all that legislation that went through because of the Queensland Greens.
Well,
how did you navigate that?
I said to him, does that mean you don't want to talk to me? Said, oh, no, ship notes. No, come on in. I want to talk to you, all right? Meet the wife, have a cup of tea.
Right.
Let me tell you about these gas companies.
Right.
And that was the reception I got just about everywhere. They said, we don't like you, Drew, but, we sure do need you. And I took the view that I wasn't there to convert anybody to anything.
Right.
I wasn't there to ask them about their politics. I was there to listen and hear their concerns and do what I can to help.
So what were their major concerns?
The fact that these companies were coming onto their land, telling them that they had to sign, giving them all sorts of, lousy agreements about coming onto their land, giving them $30 a gas well, with, $30 a year, to put this gas well on their property, which, take up over a hectare of ground, along with the pipeline that goes with it, and all the tree clearing that goes with that, and just acting like arrogant, bastards that they were.
Mm.
And so I said, "No, you don't put up with this." They, a couple of the farmers there, said, "Oh, they were really angry. A lot of them." They said, "Drew, I think this is where Rule 303 comes in."
Right.
Rule 303.
Well, that was the way things were settled in the old days. Rule 303.
Well,
You look a bit puzzled there, Daryl. Do you? You got no idea what Rule 303 was?
No, I've got no idea.
You've never heard of a 303, have you, mate?
No.
You're some type of city slicker.
Oh, I must be. All right, explain it to me. What's Rule 303?
What do I do with these people, Drew? What do I do with these people?
I'll go back to the city then.
They need to travel to Western Queensland.
Exactly.
It's a gun.
It's a gun. It's a powerful gun.
Yeah. Oh, Mauser, right.
Mauser, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, I talked to them about non-violence. And, there's a moral reason to practice non-violence, but there's also a really good strategic reason why you do. You pull that gun out, you end up in jail, you end up with everybody thinking you're a fool, and you lose the battle. You fight non-violently, but you fight hard, and you dig your heels in, and you you don't let them on your property, and you'll get people's support at the same time as you're doing the right thing. And it took it. I had to talk a lot along those lines before people got it. And the whole campaign from that moment on was Gandhian, basically.
Right. Tell us about the campaign. This was what, Close the Gates, isn't it?
Well, I was sort of pondering there, what, because any campaign has to have a leader that you pull,
right,
to get what you want. And I was looking around, what's the leader here? Because these big gas companies, the biggest gas companies in the world, you're talking Chevron and British Gas, Arrow,
right,
Petronas, they were huge companies. And a huge pocket, Santos from Australia. And they were almost all of them had their approval by this stage. So I came in a bit too late, really.
Right.
By 2010 when I got started. And so I thought, well, we need it. If we're going to have a leader, it's not going to be lobbying the government, because they already made up their mind.
So this was a Labor government, obviously. Was this the Beattie government or after the Beattie? I can't remember.
It was the Beattie government, first of all, and then it was the Bligh government.
Yep. The spokesperson who just retired for the Australian banking sector, Anna Bligh. She just retired. Some Liberal has-been has taken over, some old politician.
Well, she didn't do us any favours as Premier, I can tell you.
Right.
The lever that I decided we could pull was these companies have to actually negotiate an access and compensation agreement. And, you can't stop them coming onto your property, but they have to have an access and compensation agreement to do so. And so I said, well, you just never sign the access and compensation agreement. And you don't let them onto your property anyway. You negotiate at your front gate. So my advice to them was shut the gate. Anyway,
right.
One of the farmers rang me up and said, hey, you can't call it shut the gate, because everybody in the country shuts the gate. You can't let the cows out. you've got to lock it.
All right.
Okay, so we called it lock the gate.
Lock the gates, right.
And farmers and landholders all over Western Queensland started locking their gates.
Right.
But
it's an interesting campaign, isn't it? Because it's not about political ideology. It's about a common theme, a common problem. As you said,
right.
People have got different ideological views about different things, but they've got a common problem, and it's coming around. It's like a syndicalist union. People come around, they join because of a common issue, They work in the same place or whatever. So this locked the gate. So was it just restricted to this little area in the Darling Downs, or was
at first it was, but then and by the way, we had blockades and all sorts of things going on out there.
Right.
I got arrested, thrown into jail, other people were.
How did the local cops feel, or did they bring outside cops to arrest people? Because obviously there's a good relationship usually between the local cops and the local blockies.
I had a pretty good relationship with police. In fact, one of the fellow who arrested me at one of these blockades, then said, "Oh, Drew, how do you feel about coming and being guest speaker at our bowls club?"
Never miss an opportunity to get a free guest speaker. Yeah, I actually was once invited, this was about 20 years ago, to address a group of real estate agents, you know, about anarchism, believe it or not, in Melbourne. Yeah, they're always looking for interesting guest speakers, Drew, yeah. As long as all they pay you is a bottle of wine or at the end of the speech. Yeah.
Well, anyway, I heard that there was a cult and gas moving in on the wine areas of the Hunter Valley.
Right.
You know, and it sounds like Broke and Percolbin and so on. A beautiful area, you know, beautiful tourism, wine growing. And there was a guy in our campaign, he was a blocky from out in the Darling Downs called Dane Pratsky. And Dane was a very talented fellow. He was a great campaign. And he went down because these wine growing people called a conference of all people who were worried about gas money. And Dane went down to it. I didn't because I was so busy. And anyway, I got a call from Dane. And he said, "Hey, Drew, we're having this conference here and they wanted to set up a committee to take it forward. And I put your name forward. Is that all right?" Mm-hmm. All right. So, yep. Anyway, we had a meeting at the committee in Sydney a couple of weeks later, and we were parceling out the jobs, you know, interim jobs until we could get a conference going.
Right.
And I didn't want to be secretary because they have to do too much work, and I was already last strap in Queensland. I didn't want to be treasurer because I'm not a good money manager. Just ask my wife on that one.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to be president because the guy who'd called the meeting together, you know, should be the president.
So right.
I'll be the vice president because nobody ever knows what a vice president does, and I can probably get away with doing nothing.
Yeah.
And anyway,
good move. Good move.
Yeah, I thought so.
Right. Well, what's going on here? You thought so. I don't like the. Where's this going? You thought so. You could just relax with your feet up on your desk. But what happened?
Well, I thought so, Joe. But a week later, the president resigned because of ill health.
Right.
And I then found out what vice presidents do. They have to move up and become president.
Right.
And so I became the president of Lost the Gate Alliance.
Right.
It came just at a time when coal seam gas was sprouting up all over Australia.
Right.
So the next 5 or 6 years, I just travelled the country, the whole country.
Well, what did your partner and kids and grandkids think about this old man travelling the countries, you know, and on this campaign? Shouldn't you be home reading, you know, bedtime stories to the grandkids?
Well, they were reading about me in the papers.
Oh, right. Yeah, they were reading about you. You weren't reading to them.
There's Grandpa. There's Papa.
All right.
I must admit, it didn't do my home life any good at all.
No. That is always an issue, isn't it? That is the main issue when you're an activist. It doesn't matter what you're involved in, is that the fact that in many times you just basically... the issue takes over your life and your responsibilities as a father or as a partner or whatever, you know, kind of get pushed in the background. And what you get for it at the end of the day is basically a kick in the face.
I have a saintly wife who's put up with me for nearly 40 years now.
This is your second wife. Remember you told me you divorced. That's right.
Libby.
So she knew what she was getting into.
She sort of knew what you were getting into.
Right, right.
She was an activist herself.
Right.
There's activism and activism, and I sort of took it to extremes a bit. And I was getting actually quite old by the time this came around. I wasn't planning on, you know, spending my 60s and 70s as an activist. But, I travelled the whole country. And we had a lot of successes, and the... And we extended into coal mining as well. It wasn't just gas, it was coal mines, and the Lock the Gate Alliance still combats and often wins against attempt to approve new expanded coal mines.
But we've seen more and more legislation come into play to actually try to derail any type of movement that's extra parliamentary these days. What do you think about the new legislation that state governments, the federal governments are talking about introducing to restrict protest and activity?
It's disgraceful. It's absolutely disgraceful. And it's Labor governments quite often that are doing it.
Well, that's right. You know, under current legislation, you can actually be jailed up to 25 years for being, for taking part in an occupation. I mean, occupations were part and parcel of everyday political activity, you know, when we were much younger.
Well, you know, not even Bjelke Petersen did that.
No.
I've basically never been in jail more than overnight. And, you know, not 25 years and not even, months.
There are green activists now who find themselves in jail. 2 months, 3 months, 4 months, who take direct action.
It's just despicable. And, the thing about direct action is, and if it's non-violent, even if it's civil disobedience, there are various rules, and if you stick to the rules of non-violence, you're simply making your point, prepared to accept the consequences. As long as those consequences aren't incredibly dire, then it's something that everybody can recognise and appreciate. And it's not aimed at making everybody's life difficult. It's attempting to place an issue before people in a dramatic way that gets them thinking about it. And these horrific pieces of legislation are just simply an authoritarian measure designed to stop that process from occurring, which is part of democracy.
Yeah, like they're in Victoria, they're talking about, well, they're going to introduce lock-on legislation, you know. I'll just have to bigger jails. That's all I'll have to do. I mean, you can't even move. I mean, it's just extraordinary the amount of restrictive legislation that is now on the books. And to a significant degree, it occurs because of our constitution, which doesn't protect the individual from the arbitrary exercise of state power. So they can basically do what they like if they've got a majority in both houses of parliament.
Well, and the world seems to be going that way, Joe. It's getting more and more polarised and more and more authoritarian on both the left and the right.
Both sides, that's correct. So what have you been doing the last few years? When did did you kind of peter out of energy with the lock the gate movement?
Well, the biggest victory we had was actually in northern New South Wales. The gas industry made a big mistake of trying to move into northern New South Wales because the sort of, all of these old hippies and new settlers, had moved into the area and allied with the local farmers and local landowners, local townspeople, and a huge move there, massive move. A number of blockades culminating in the blockade at Bentley, just outside Lismore.
Right.
And just to cut a long story short there, because it was a huge campaign, we had a blockade, and we actually had a town set up, a tent city,
right,
full of blockaders, about 2,000 people at it, and the drilling rig was coming into the area, and we knew it was coming, so we put out the call. We'd have had 10,000 people at a blockade. And there were 800 police came to try to make sure this drilling rig got through, and it was really tense. I was petrified. But all it takes is just one silly idiot to throw a stone, and we would have a riot. Anyway, the police blinked, the government blinked, and ordered the gas company out, the police out, and we won. There's no gas in the northern rivers, nor is there ever likely to be. Anyway, I got really ill. I got a number of conditions and could hardly walk. I was walking with a walking stick and couldn't get out of bed in the morning.
Right.
And I was getting depression along with all that.
Right.
And, by 2017, you know, I was 70 years of age, and I thought I'm more of a drag on the movement than a health system, you know,
right.
With all of this. So I finally resigned and retired as an activist.
Right.
Libby and I decided we'd have a normal life.
What? You're going to read to the grandkids? Well, they're too old now to listen to you.
I love them to bits.
Right. Yeah. Well, it is, it is. I mean, at the end of the day, activism, being active, there's a lot of brickbats and very few bouquets, and there's not many victories either. But you do change things by standing up for yourself, and that's the key, isn't it, standing up. Because, you know, as they say, the standard you walk by is the standard, you know, you support, basically.
Yeah.
And the trouble is, too many people these days, they just allow things to just flow past them and think, well, oh, it's not my issue, you know.
Yeah, well, that's what got me into trouble recently. I think we're probably running out of time. I'm really concerned about how the left in this country and in countries all around the world
right.
is becoming more and more authoritarian, less and less concerned about free speech, less and less concerned about democratic process, more and more concerned about moralistic posturing and virtue signalling rather than trying to get, you know, proper outcomes
right.
from campaigning which engages in rational and civil discussion and debate and more intent on cancelling people and expelling them and getting them back from their positions or their jobs.
Yeah, well, that's the Achilles heel, isn't it, of the left? If you forget... You forget your history where you come from and you take on that position. I mean, I believe that identity politics to a significant degree is what you do when you know you can't beat the system, you know?
I agree.
You know,
it's
and...
It's all back into your tribe.
Yeah.
It's all back into your tribe.
Yeah.
It's all about the power of my tribe.
Yeah.
And it's not about, you know, our common humanity at all.
Although I think the situation in Gaza is waking people up to the extent to which the state will go, you know, to just extraordinary situation that'll go. And you're quite right there. But I think younger activists don't see that. They kind of just follow the line. That's my opinion. Maybe because we're getting old, Drew, and we're no longer relevant. Maybe that's the way the world has changed.
I think all those values are still relevant. That's the point I'm trying to make.
But
it's not just simply a new generation. I mean, you and I came from the generation that broke away from, you know, the sort of more authoritarian forms of Marxism.
That's right.
And you know, I'm sure the current generation of activists are saying, oh, well, we're just trying to break away from those old, forms of left-wing politics. But what they're doing is breaking away from the best aspects of that, which are things like non-violence and democracy.
Right.
And instead of saying there are universal values which the left should always adhere to, they're saying no. It's all about identity, and it's all, you know, it's all about identifying the enemy as not the big corporations or authoritarian government, but people who disagree with you, including people on the left. And identifying, for example, a feminist as your enemy just seems to me to be so absurd.
These are debates which are going to go on for a long, long time, obviously after we're gone, but I think people need to wake up to what's actually happening around the place. So thank you very much, Drew, for sharing your life. It's very important that people understand that, you know, you've put 50 years, over 50 years of putting yourself forward for other people for over 50 years. And I think it's exceptionally important that we remember our history. And that's the purpose of Talk Back with Attitude. Sorry, that's the purpose of Radical Australia. I got my programs mixed up. I may not agree with some of the people that come on, but I want to talk to them and I want their stories to be heard. And that's the key. We need everybody's stories to be heard who are anti-authoritarian and who describe themselves as on the left. Thank you very much, Drew, and all the best. And hopefully you don't find another issue to fight at the age of 78.
Thank you, Joe. It was lovely talking to you.
All the very best. Thank you very much.
Okay, bye.
Bye. Thank you, Daryl. I've got to turn off the phone, Daryl.
Well, he hung up.
Next week, we've got an older bloke. You think 78's old? We've got an 86-year-old, a long-time listener to 3CR, and he was actually involved in, building the 3CR studios at Cromwell Street in 1976.
Oh, right.
So an old member of the BLF, one of the old-fashioned activists, you know.
Right.
And not like Drew, who's a pacifist. I mean, this bloke, in those days, the biff was always on if you're in radical politics. So,
right.
So
right.
I think we should have a pretty exciting... Unfortunately, the lad kind of feels a little bit elderly and a little bit fragile, so it's going to be a phone interview, although he lives in Melbourne. So,
yeah.
But
yeah.
We'll get some sparks going.
Oh, well, I was thinking we're not... Oh, so he's not coming in. I was thinking we might have had to carry him in or something.
No. He'd carry you in, mate.
Oh, would he?
He's a character and a half. And you got different generations and you have different ways of approaching the same issues.
Oh, yeah. I like that generation. They had such a different approach to things. Different from now.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, you know, there's a lot of nonsense now they wouldn't put up with.
No.
Back in those days, you know.
No, and they didn't.
No.
Yeah. All right, we better go on. We better leave the studio.
Mm.
You've got another program coming, have you?
Yep. Okay, so you have been listening to Radical Australia with presenter Joe Toscano and guest Drew Hutton here on 3CR Community Radio. 8:55 AM on your dial or online at 3cr.org.au, and this program has been podcasted. Stay tuned now for Brainwaves coming right up.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.